Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Yud Amud Aleph, five lines down. The Gemara here is discussing the position of Rava with regards to Pagin and Dibura, the ability to bifurcate a person's testimony, to take the testimony that is relevant and render a verdict based on that testimony, and to discard the other testimony which they can't work with because of the individual's relationship, whether it's to his wife, to himself, and we're going to see possibly to his property, that causes him to be disqualified with regards to part of the statements that he makes. So the examples that we had in yesterday's daf, which is that if an individual comes along and says that Ploni Rivani Lirtsoni, that someone sodomized me, but I was a willing participant in that act. So in that instance, we, Balginan Dibura, we bifurcate his statement. We believe him with regards to the party that perpetrated the sodomy. On the other hand, we do not believe him with regards to himself because Ein Adam Metzim Etzmo Rasha. Person doesn't have the ability, the right, to make himself into a Rasha. And so therefore, we don't believe him with regards to his statement. Yesterday, we saw two explanations that derived from the Balei HaTosafot. One explanation is that we look at the wording of his statement, and we say that if we could take the portion of the statement and drop another portion of the statement, and it would still make sense, or it would be logical what we are saying, then we go ahead and do that. For instance, in the case of Ploni Ivani Lirtsoni, then your Ploni Ivo Leonso or Lirtsono, you can drop the Lirtsono or the Onso, which describes his participation in the act, and simply keep the first part of this statement, which is Ploni Ivo Ploni Ivani. So that you could do and come out with a full-fledged testimony. And in that case, we will say Pogina and Dibura. It also means that it's something whereby the latter statement is not relevant to him, which is that in this case, the person who is perpetrating the crime of sodomy doesn't matter whether the other party was a willing participant or an unwilling participant. The statement about what he did is relevant in either case. He is culpable for the death penalty in either instance. So therefore, the Lirtsono or the Onso only has an impact on the victim or the participant. It doesn't have an impact on the perpetrator of the crime. And for that reason, in addition, that's what the Rashba says over here. We both look at the language, and can you parse the language? And number two is the case. Is the information that we have sufficient when you look at it alone? Do we not need the other information? Lirtsono or Onso is not information that's important to the conviction of the individual perpetrated the sodomy. So that's the view of the Rashba, and the Ramban in Ketubot says something along those lines as well. The Balei HaTosafot brought a suggestion like that and rejected it. Then the Balei HaTosafot said that Pagin Dibur has to do with the number of Gufin, the number of objects that's involved here. If we're dealing with two objects, then we can split the testimony, and we can say that the testimony with regards to one object is relevant, to the other object is irrelevant or discarded. Whereas if it's one object, we can't go ahead and divide up your statement because you're speaking about the single individual, and therefore will not say or apply Pogina Dibura. Those are the two suggestions that we saw yesterday. There is a third view of the Ravid. I quoted him in the view of the Rashba as well, which is that he believes that the testimony with regards to the individual himself is as if it doesn't exist. And so that would help the view of the Rashba, maybe even the Ritva, that you drop a portion of what is being said because of the lack of relevance of that portion. That lack of relevance, according to the Ravid, is because since a person is karov l'atzmo, it's as if his testimony is meaningless. But the Ravid goes on to say something more important, which is, what's the difference between a case where he's testifying about a relative versus a case where he's testifying about himself? If an individual comes along and testifies about his relative, then his edut is betela. We don't say there pagina dibura. We say there that edut de betela miksata betela kula. That if you have an edut where there's a problematic part to it, for instance, you're a karov, then that extends or affects the entire edut and it ruins the entire edut. On the other hand, when he testifies about himself, we say pagina dibura. Why do we make such a distinction? So the Ravid claims it's because when you testify about a karov, your testimony is good testimony. Just happens to be that there's a gzeret ha-katuv that says you may not testify about a karov, or that the possibility that you are nogea b'davar, we've seen in Baba Batra that that's not the reasoning, but rather it's a gzeret ha-katuv, But nevertheless, that testimony is a fair testimony. It's just disqualified testimony. In that case, we will apply the principle of edut b'teila miksata b'teila kula. On the other hand, in a case where the person testifies about themselves, that is not testimony. It's not just because he's a karov, it's a letzmo. It's the fact that the testimony that you say about yourself is meaningless. It's not called edut. A person doesn't have the capacity to testify about himself. He only has the capacity to speak about himself. He doesn't have the capacity to testify about himself. And therefore, we drop that testimony completely. And that's the way the Ravid explains Pagina Dibura, which is that in an instance where the Eidut disappears because it's not Eidut, then we say Pagina Dibura. The other hand, if the Eidut is disqualified, then we say that Eidut B'teila Miksata B'teila Kula. That something that is ruined in part is ruined then in full. And then using that, the Ramban, who quotes this Ravid in the Gemara in Makot, says that the Ar Gemara is supportive of that view of the Ravid, which is that over here, the next line in the Gemara for Rava was a case where an individual comes to testify about an adulterer that had an affair with his wife. So over there, the Gemara asks, do we say Pagina Dibura or do we not say Pagina Dibura? Where it says, Hainuach, isn't that all the same situation? Isn't the same case? Adam is Karov Etzalatzmo, and therefore we will disqualify, drop that testimony for all the different reasons we saw, whether it's the Rashba, the Bali Tosafot, or the Ravid. And then you will keep the testimony about the adulterer, and he will be put to death by the testimony of the husband of the wife who's involved in that affair, as well as a third party who testified. So the Gemara says, no, 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 we have a Havamina there, that when it comes to Eitzel Ishto, we do not say that he's Karov like Atzmo. And that, the Ramban says, exactly what the Ravid is saying. The question of the Gemara is, what is the relationship between a husband and a wife? Is the relationship between a husband and a wife like that of other Krovim? Other relatives, by which, if you testify for them, your testimony is disqualified, and that disqualification then ruins all the testimony? Or is your testimony about your wife similar to testimony about yourself, whereby we would say that it's gone? It's as if it doesn't exist. And that's what the Gemara comes to a conclusion, Kamash Malan, that Ishto Kugufo, in essence, and the testimony about his wife is exactly like testimony about himself, which is that the testimony doesn't exist. Since it doesn't exist, then we can be Paginan Dibura. And that's how the Ravid draws a distinction between other relatives and the individual himself. But it also helps to explain the Gemara on the top of Yudav and Aleph with regards to Rava's statement over there. So that's what we left off with yesterday. Now we're beginning five lines down with another statement of Rava. V'amar Rava, Ploni Baal and Hara Hamurasa. So-and-so consorted with a woman who was engaged halachically. V'huzmu. And then Edim come along and say that these individuals, imanu aitem, the edim that are testifying as you were with us, you couldn't have testified to this, neharagim. The edim, zomamim, now are killed because they were trying to kill this individual who consorted with this nara umarasa. So we know that the punishment is kasher zamam lasot. What they plan to do to the other party, they will then get punished with. And what they plan to do was to kill this individual. So now they will be killed. Ve'ein mishalmi mamon. And they don't have to pay any money over here. The reason being, as Rashi notes over here, is because we don't know who the Nara Hamurasa is. We don't know who the Nara Hamurasa is because all they said was so-and-so consorted with the Nara Hamurasa. They never identified the woman who was the Nara Hamurasa. Had they identified the woman, then she would have lost out on her ktubah. And then there would be a monetary issue over here. And that monetary issue, then they would have to pay for the loss of the ktubah that this Nara Hamurasa would have been subject to. So the reason Ein Mishalmi Mamon is because they didn't identify the Nara Hamurasa. On the other hand, Bito Shel Ploni V'huzmu, if they identify the Nara Hamurasa in their testimony, then Neharagin, they are killed, U'Mishalmi Mamon, and then they have to pay for the loss of the ktubah, or the loss that would be suffered because of the fact that this Nara Hamurasa had an extramarital affair. The reason being is, Mamon Lezeh, Benafsho Lezeh. The money goes to one party, and the death penalty comes from another party. In explaining the difference between the two scenarios that Rava brought down, in the first scenario, they do not identify the Nara Hamurasa. That's why there's no monetary obligation. In the second instance, they identify the Nara Hamurasa, and therefore there is a monetary loss that caused, and we hold them culpable for that monetary loss as well, because as Edim Zomamim, they are subject to punishments from two different parties. The money's coming from one, and the death penalty is coming from another. In that case, we saw yesterday that you're chayav for both, the death penalty and the monetary obligation. Now, as far as what's the chiddush about the fact that the Na'aram Rosef, they don't identify her, that they're not chayav for the mamon, of course, if they don't identify her, then they don't have to pay the money because they never caused her to lose the money. The answer might be is that by a Na'ara Hamurasa, in the end, they will have to identify the woman. Because the only way to know that this person consorted with a Na'ara Hamurasa is to know the woman that he consorted with. So it is important who the woman is, and it is important that she's a Na'ara Hamurasa. And that will come out in the cross-examination of the witnesses by the Beit Din. So you might have thought, since that name or that information comes out in the cross-examination, even though in the end they did not cause her to lose her ketubah because they didn't testify about her, but since it comes out in that cross-examination, maybe then they should be held culpable for the possible loss of her ketubah that would have been caused because now they're identifying her. The kamashulan is that they are not chayav for that monetary obligation, but when they do identify the woman, they are chayav for that monetary obligation. Now Fred pointed out that didn't we have this case exactly yesterday? And in that case, Rabbi Yosef said, you are neharagim, ve'enim mishalmim mamon, that the edim zalmim are subject to a death penalty, and they don't pay money. Whereas over here, Rabbi is saying that they do pay money. They're neharagim, and they pay money. Yesterday, we said the reason that they are not killed and pay money is because the woman has both aspects here. The woman is going to be put to death because she was involved in a consensual relationship while she was in a na'ara murasa. That means that she is chayevet mita b'skila, and then she also will lose her ketubah. So then when you find these edim to be edim zomamim, they should have to deal with both of the things they caused her. One is the death penalty, and number two is the loss of her ketubah. But the problem is that since they are both related to her, we don't have a case where you get the death penalty and you have to pay the money. So because of that, since they relate to the single individual, the woman, we say that the edim zomamim will get a death penalty, but they will not have to pay. Yet Rob over here says they get the death penalty and they have to pay. The answer is the difference in the cases. The case in yesterday was a case of Motzi Shemra. The case of Motzi Shemra is where the woman already is married. Not only she was a Na'ara Murasa, but now the marriage was consummated. The husband took her and now makes a claim that she wasn't a betula, that she had some sort of an extramarital affair before they got married. But at this point, she has nisuin with this individual because they consummated the marriage. In our case over here, it's simply a Na'ara Hamurasa. The difference being, who owns the benefit of that money or that ketubah? When the woman reaches the point of nisuin, she then severs the relationship with her father and now becomes a party to the bow. But she also has her own ownership now. And that means if she gets divorced or anything that happens with her ketubah, the value, the money, the compensation that comes from that all goes to her because she's now the owner of her ketubah. And then when you deal with the Na'ara Murasa, she has yet to consummate her marriage. And since she hasn't yet to consummate her marriage, she's still under the auspices of her father. And that means that anything that happens during that period of time, the father is the beneficiary of that because of the principle that we have, kol shevach ne'ureha. Any production, value, benefit that comes from her being a ne'ara accrues to her father. And so in this instance, the loss of the ketubah is a loss to her father. And the penalty that's going to be paid over here by the edim zomamim is going to accrue to the father and not to the ne'ara murasa. And for that reason, Rob over here says, ne'aragim u'mishalmim. Unlike the case of Rav Yosef yesterday, where we're speaking about the Motzi Shemra, over there they didn't have to pay because they were paying to the same woman who they had subjected possibly to a death penalty. So they're being killed for that. They don't have to pay. Over here, the death penalty will come to them either because of the other individual, the man that was involved, or because of the woman, because they wanted to put the Na'ara Murasa to death. But the money will be paid to the father of the Na'ara Murasa. And that was what it means over here, that mamon lezeh, nafshot lezeh, which is that the mamon is going to the father, and the death penalty is coming from the Na'ara Hamurasa. And for that reason, edim zomamim here would do both, have to pay and be subject to the death penalty, unlike what we saw yesterday. All right, v'omar Rava. Rava now gives us another din, which is, Ploni Rava Hashor, so and so had a relationship with the animal, was engaged in bestiality, v'huzmu, and then they are found to be edim zomimim neharagim. They are then put to death. Ve'ein mishalmim mamon. They don't have to pay for the shor. The shor is also subject to a death penalty because any animal involved in bestiality. So the animal is killed irrespective of the animal's participation or why it participated, even though it was compelled by a human being to do it. So here, what the Gemara says is that they are held accountable for trying to kill the individual they claimed was involved in bestiality, but they're not responsible to pay for the shor that would be killed. Once again here, the reason being is because it is a shor that they did not identify. They do not identify who the animal is in this instance. So they just simply said he had consorted with an animal, the animal wasn't identified, and that's why they don't have to pay the money for it. Now in this case, in the cross-examination, it may never come out whose animal it is, because it's not relevant. Doesn't matter who owns the animal. Doesn't matter whether the animal was a consensual, non-consensual partner. Doesn't matter whether the animal was owned by that party or another party. None of that is meaningful. The fact that it's an animal is the only meaningful fact, and therefore in the cross-examination, they may never have to identify whose animal it was, or who's the owner of the animal. It just needs to know that it was an animal. For that reason, they're put to death, but they don't pay for the loss that they would have caused in the killing of the shor, because we have no idea who the owner of the shor is. Shoro shoploni, if they identify which shor it was that this person had performed that act of bestiality with, vehuzmu, and then they're found to be edim zomimim, neharagim umishamim mamon. They are both put to death, and they have to pay for the loss of the shor that's going to be niskam. Mamon azeh unefshot azeh. That's because the death penalty relates to one party, the party that they claim consorted with this animal. On the other hand, the animal itself, which is owned by another person, is also going to be killed here. And since they had their testimony been accepted, they would have killed the individual and the shor. Now, when they're found to be edim zomimim, they have to subject to a death penalty for trying to kill this individual and have to pay for the shor because they tried to kill the individual shor, remove his property. Where it says, Hatu lomali. What do I need this case? Hainu hach. It's the exact same as the previous case. The case of Nara Amrusa and the case of the shor are identical. The Gemara says the same thing in both cases. Rava says in the first case, if you don't identify the Nara Amrusa, the din is that they get killed, no monetary payment. If they identify the Nara Amrusa, then you have the death penalty and payment. Similarly in this case, if they don't identify the shor, then there's a death penalty to them and no monetary payment. If they did identify the shor, then there's both a death penalty and a monetary obligation. Bishom, the Karboi, Baya, Ilave. The reason it's brought down is because we have a question on it. Over here, there's an assumption of a certain factor, and that assumption is going to be challenged now by Rova. The Boi Rova, Rova asked on this case, Ploni Rava Shori Mahu. So-and-so had a relationship with my animal. Mi Amrinan Adam Karov Itzalatzmo. Do we say a person is considered to be a relative to himself? And rasha. So he can't testify about himself. But the adam karov etzel mamono. But when it comes to his possessions, there he's not considered to be a karov. Odilma amrinan adam karov etzel mamono. Or do we say that a person is classified as a relative with regards to his possessions? Balter debayu, after he had posed the question. Now the question here relates to the case of shor, does not obviously relate to the case of Nara Amrusa. In the cases of Nara Amrusa, or the cases before we said Pagin and Dibura, we always said Pagin and Dibura when it related to the individual himself, where he testified about himself. So in the first case it's about himself, the second case of his wife, which is like himself. Now we have a third scenario, which is he testifying about his possessions. What is the relationship of an individual to his possessions? So Balter Dabai, after Rava posed the question, Hodar Pashta, he answered the question, Adam Karov Eitzel Atzmo, Vein Adam Karov Eitzel Memono. A person is considered to be a relative to himself, but he's not considered to be a relative with regards to his money. Now over here, you have two possible explanations of the Gemara. Turns out to be a machloki between Rashi and the Rambam on one side, and you have the Ravid and the Ramban on the other side. And that is, what is meant over here that a person is considered to be karov etzel mimono? A person is considered to be a relative with regards to his money, what type of impact does that have? So going back to the Ravid that we saw before, the Ravid identified for us that if you are classified as a relative, then a dush bitela mixtata bitala kula. If you're just a relative, if you're just a karov, that will ruin the edut completely. On the other hand, when you speak about the person themselves, that testimony is completely invalid and irrelevant. And since that's the case, we just drop that, and then the remaining part of his testimony is kept. And we say pagin and dibura. And what the Gemara is asking over here, according to the Ravid, is the exact same thing, which is a person considered to be a karov etzel mamano, or is he not considered to be a karov etzel mamano? Be the same as about him testifying about himself, is when he testified about his possessions. And like the Ravid said before, when you testify about yourself, that testimony gets dropped completely. It's irrelevant. So that's what we would say here as well. In the case where he's testifying ashore, and he's considered to be a karov to the money, meaning it's like him himself testifying about himself. In that case, we drop that testimony, and then we will obligate the individual who performed the act of bestiality with this person's animal. We'll drop his testimony about his own animal, and then we'll keep the other part of the testimony. On the other hand, if you say that the person is not considered to be a karov itzel, is mimono, then his money or his possessions become like any other karov, any other relative. And that means when you testify about a relative, it's disqualified or improper edut. So to over here, when you testify about your own possessions, that's considered to be an edut that is problematic. An edut, shibitela mixata, bitela kula. So that's the question according to the Ravid, according to the Ramban. Question that's being posed over here is, do we either obligate the party that performed the act of bestiality because we drop the testimony about the animal, and say pagin and dibura because it's considered as if you're testifying about yourself? Or do we say that the money is like any other relative and it's a testimony that would be problematic, disqualified, and edut shebitilah mixata bitilah kula, and therefore your testimony both about the animal and about this individual will be ignored because it's a problematic testimony, and neither of them will be put to death? So that's the question here. Do you put only the person who performed the act to death, or you put neither of them to death? And the Gemara's conclusion is that person is not classified as a karov, meaning that he's not considered to be he himself when it regards to his money. And therefore, according to the conclusion of the Ramban and the Ravid, we would say over here that nobody gets the death penalty. On the other hand, Rashi views the question here differently. Rashi views the question as being, do we say that a person is a karov etzel mimono? If he's a karov etzel mimono, we will discard that part of his testimony and say pagin and dibura. He won't be believed about the shor. He will be believed about the other individual, and the other individual will be put to death. On the other hand, if we say a person is not karov etzel shoro, he's not considered to be a nogeya badavar, quote-unquote, a karov to his mamon, then in that case, not only will the individual be put to death, so will the shor be put to death. Both of them will be put to death. And you can see that in the Rabbeinu Chananel as well. It says, Ve'imeid kiploni ravashuri, who v'acher mitzarfim lehorgo leroveya v'liskol ashor, that they get together to both put the person who performed the act of bestiality and the animal to death, because it's not considered to be a karov. His testimony is accepted fully, both with regards to the animal and with regards to the human being, and therefore both of them are put to death, according to Rashi. If we had thought that he was a relative to the shor, that would have disqualified the part of his testimony with regards to the shor, but would have kept alive without which the individual who performed the act, and we would have said Poginan Dibura. So that's the view of the Ravid versus the view of Rashi. And again, you can see this also in a machloket between the Rambam and the Ravid in Hilchot Eidut, where the Rambam writes, Ploni Ravad Shori, Hu Vacher Mitztarfim Lahor Go, She'ein Adam Karov Eitzel Mimono. And the Kesef Mishnah over there says, Umifaresh Rabbeinu Kirashi, Sheperish the Kevin Dein Adam Karov Eitzel Mimono, Lo Poginan Dibura. There's no split in his testimony, but Ashor Yisakel. Not only is the person put to death, but so is the shor put to death. And the Ravid in his Yarot over there says, Ve'yesh Mifarshim, Ploni Ravad Sharish, Gamaroveya Eino Ne'arag. Nobody's put to death. V'fiche Eidut Naga Al Shoro. He's no Geba Davar by his shor. Delo Pagin and Dibura. V'gamo Shoronit Ka'evein Nahayit. And he intended to testify about his shor as well. Shem Sheinu Ne'man Al Shoro. Just like he's not believed by his shor. Kach Einu Ne'man Al Roveya. Eidut Shemteila Mixata V'teila Kula. And that's the Ravid that we saw before. This concept that's brought up by the Ravid. So those are two different ways to read the Gemara. And obviously has a major nafkamina in the conclusion. The Ravid Lishitoto, as we mentioned above, explains why we say, or when we say, Pagin Dibura. Rashi, on the other hand, disagrees with that and we'll have to say something along the lines of the Balei HaTosafot or someone else who explains this idea of Palgin and Dibura. And Rashi will also say that with regards to Kirva, Itzo Mimono, when it comes to Kirva over there, it's a question of, is there Kirva or is there nothing? On the other hand, the way that the Ramban understands the Ravid, he says that it's a question of whether you are considered to be such a close relative that it's you yourself, that's one side, or are you just like a regular relative, not like you yourself? And he writes that that view of the Ravid is supported by this view in the Gemara. Now, what Rashi explained in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, this is the Ramban in Makot, he says that that is incorrect. Right? So those are the two different ways to read this Gemara. Alright, so now the Gemara continues, Makot Bishlosha. And when it comes to lashes, corporal punishment, you need a Beit Din of three. Menahani Mile. How do you know that you need a Beit Din of three? So, we know that there is a machloket here in the Mishnah as to whether by corporal punishment you need 3 or you need 23. So now, the Gemara says, according to one who says 3, what is the derivation of 3? Now you can't say that it's a kal v'chomer from Mamon. If Mamon needs 3, then certainly Malkot need 3, because we also know that there's an exception by Mamon from Mumchim. That when it comes to a Mumche l'Rabim, he can adjudicate alone. And by Malkot, by corporal punishment, we always need Mumchim. So maybe there's a possibility that one would suffice over here because you're requiring mumchim, as opposed to memanot, where you're going to have shlosha hedyotot. So Gemara wants to know, where do you know 3 from? So Amar Rav Huna, Amar Kra, the pasuk says in Parshat Ki Teitze, Ki Yeriv ben Anashim v'nikshu el ha-mishpat u'shvatum v'itztiku et ha-tzadik v'irshiu et ha-rasha. So when there's an altercation between parties, they're going to go to the court, and u'shvatum, they're going to adjudicate the case, decide the case. V'itztiku et ha-tzadik, they're going to acquit, exonerate the individual who is innocent. V'yirshiu et ha-rasha, and then they're going to implicate the one who is guilty. So now it says, u'shvatum. When it comes to the shvatum, it's written in the plural. So that says shnayim. That means you need a minimum of 2 judges. Ben beit din shakul, and you can't work with a beit din that is even. Mosifim alem od echad, erikan shlosha. That's how you get to the 3. Ela mi'ato. If that's the case, what about the remainder of the pasuk? If you're looking at the verbs in the pasuk, it says ushvatum, but also says v'yitztiku and v'hirshiu. So then say v'yitztiku is shnayim, v'hirshiu is another 2, hare kan shiv'a, because you have 2 from shvatum, 2 from v'yitztiku, 2 from v'hirshiu, that's 6. You can't have an even baked in, that turns out to be 7. When it says, how can we buy like the ula? V'yitztiku et tzadik v'hirshiu et the rasha, we need for the drasha of ula, the amar ula. Remez the Edim Zomimim in a Torah Minayin. Where is the hint to Edim Zomimim in the Torah? Mar says, Remez the Edim Zomimim? What do you mean a Remez the Edim Zomimim? Edim Zomimim is explicit in the Torah. Baktiv, Kasher Zamam Lasot. Mean that you punish them the way that they had planned or tried to do to their fellow Jew. The Torah explicitly talks about Edim Zomimim. You don't need a Remez. Where is there a hint in the Torah to the fact that Edim Zomimim are subject to Malkot? Now we know that the punishment of Edim Zomimim is not Malkot, it's Kasher Zamam Lasot Le'achiv. It's what he had planned to do to his friend, that's what they will be punished with. So why is there Malkot? We're speaking about here something we'll get to in the beginning of Masechet Makot, which is that in some instances it's impossible to do Kasher Zamam. For instance, a case where they testify about a Kohen. They come in and say about this Kohen that he's really a Ben Grusha v'chalutza, that he was a product of a marriage that was illegal, and that marriage makes him into a Kohen Chalal, and then disqualifies him from being a Kohen. So they come into court lying and saying that. Then they're found to be Edim Zomimim. How do we punish them now? They're not Kohanim. So now how are you going to do Kasher Zamam Lasot Le'achiv? You can't do it there because the Kohen is affected by his being a Kohen. They are not Kohanim. Even if they were Kohanim, how do you do that? Can you strip them of their Kohuna? Does that really work? So there the Gemara says that in those instances you get Malkot. It's the alternate punishment when you can't do Kasher Zamam Lasot Le'achiv, the alternate punishment is Malkot. So that's the question that Ula is trying to address is, where's the remez to the fact that you get these Malkot in those types of situations? Dichtiv, because the pasuk says, V'itztiku et ha-tzadik, v'yirshiu et ha-rasha. Bishum v'itztiku et ha-tzadik, v'yirshiu et ha-rasha. Then, the pasuk continues, the next pasuk, which is, V'ayah im bin hakot ha-rasha, if the Rasha is deserving of Malkot, then you give him Malkot, and then Arbi'im Yakenu, Lo Yosif, Pen Yosif, Lakoto Alele, Makar Rabav, Nikla Achicha Le'enecha. So here's the punishment of Malkot, the 40 lashes that come. It's really 39, as we'll learn in the Gemara. But those lashes are a result of the previous pasuk. If you would deserve lashes, you will get lashes. Why do you deserve lashes? Because the pasuk before it says, V'itztikwa de tzadik, v'yirshuwa de rasha. So now, it makes sense that v'yirshuwa de rasha, if the individual is found guilty, then the malkot are relevant to him. But why, if the tzadik is found to be innocent, why does that have any relevance to the fact that the rasha gets malkot? The acquittal or the exoneration of the tzaddik should have absolutely no impact on the fact that the rasha gets malkot. Ella, this is a hint to edim shirshiwa et tzaddik. These edim came and lied, and they therefore caused to be convicted the tzaddik, the person who was innocent. Va'atu ede achrine, and then other edim come and say imanu aitim. Can they straighten out the situation? And they made the innocent person now be the innocent party. They return the original tzaddik, the original innocent party, to his innocence. And the yeshiva the rasha is not about the party they testified about, but rather about they themselves. They are then made into rishaim. And then they get malkot. So in essence, what he's saying is that v'itztikwa de tzaddik is speaking about the party that they tried to convict or find guilty by their lying testimony. So that's the tzaddik who they had tried to make into a rasha. They deem to come and testify against them and say, mano eat them, then return it to its original state where the party who's innocent remains innocent. Yeshua the rasha. Now the edim zomimim are on the hook for their testimony. And we have to do to them, kashez amam nasot de achiv. And here you say, v'ayim bin kakot rasha, if he's subject to malkot. So you see from here that edim zomimim are subject to malkot. Where it says, v'tzibikule milotane, why do you need to learn it out of here? Learn it out of the pasuk, milotane b'recha eid shoker. If you can't lie, then that's the lav that you're looking for, and that lav would be subject to malkot. Yishum t'havale lav she'ein bo ma'aseh. Because it is a lav that does not have an action involved with it. And b'chol lav she'ein bo ma'aseh en lokim alav. Any lav that does not have an active, does not require an action to violate the negative precept, you don't get malkot from. You don't get malkot for that lav. That's for one of two reasons. Rashi quotes one of the sources, which is from, we'll see again, later on in the Masechta. We also see it in Makot as well, which is that lav she'ein bo ma'aseh is not subject to malkot because it says, v'im lo tishmor la'asot, v'iflah Hashem et makotcha. So there it says, if you don't keep the precepts, la'asot, to do, meaning that you do something that violates the precepts, then v'iflah Hashem et makotcha, then Hashem will increase your makot. So that's one way to learn it. The other way to learn it is the juxtaposition here between the parsha that we just read and the next pasuk in Parshat Ki Teitzei, which is Lo Tachshom Shor B'Disho. And the Gemara learns from that that the malkot that are found in the previous psukim are using Lo Tachshom Shor B'Disho, do not muzzle an animal while it's working, while it's threshing, as a paradigmatic lav or negative precept that you're chayav malkot for. And just like Lo Tachshom Shor B'Disho is that the person violates that by doing something actively, so too, only lavin that involve activity or violation through activity are subject to malkot. Lo taneh berecha et shoker is not an action, it's simply dibur, it's a lying when they testify. So since that, lo taneh berecha et shoker is a lav she'ein bo ma'aseh, you wouldn't have learned malkot for the edim zomim from there, and that's why we need this limud of ula. So limud of ula then uses up v'itztikwa de tzaddik v'yirshuwa de rasha, and then we're only left with the word ushvatum, which is in plural, and that ushvatum gives you two, and then we add a one to make it an odd numbered baked in. That's how we get the three for makot for corporal punishment. Rabbi Shmuel disagrees and says that you need a baked in of 23 for corporal punishment. My time with the Rabbi Shmuel. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Shmuel? I'm Rabbi, Acha Rasha, Rasha Michaive Mitot. It's a Gzeira Shova from death penalties. Tivacha, it says over here, Vaya im bin hakota Rasha. Over here, when talking about Malkot, it says, if he is subject to Malkot, or he is obligated to receive Malkot, Chtivotam, and it says there, what we just read in last week's Parsha, Asher hu rasha lamut, in a case of an individual who is a murderer, and therefore he is a rasha lamut, he is a rasha that is subject to the death penalty, The word Rasha appears in both cases. Malalan Besrim Bishlosha, Avkan Besrim Bishlosha. Just like over there, it's 23. So too over here, it's 23. We know that for capital crimes and capital punishment, we require a Beit Din of 23. So too over here, we will require a Beit Din of 23. Rava Amar, Rava says, you don't need that. That's a bias explanation that it's a Gzereshava. Rava says, you don't need the Gzereshava. And it seems from here, that's what Tosafot says, Mashmo, the late leg Gzereshava, the Rasha Rasha. Says that, it seems like he doesn't have that Gzereshava. Rather, he explains it like this. Malkot, b'makom mita omedet. Malkot, corporal punishment stands in the stead of a death penalty. The way that Rashi writes it, and the Balei Tosafot, after bringing two other explanations, say that they think Rashi's explanation is the best explanation and the right explanation. Rashi says over here, Kevin davar azharat boro, when you violate the command of your creator, ro'oi hulamut, you should be put to death. You are now a moreid b'malchut. Moreid b'malchut is subject to the death penalty, and therefore you should be subject to a death penalty over here for violating the precept, the negative precepts of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Umita zu knas alav katuv. The Torah prescribes this death penalty for him, the corporal punishment. Verihuyu ki'achat min hamitot. And it's like one of the other death penalties that we know of, just like skila is by itself, srefa is by itself, hereg is by itself. Malkot is also like one of those mitot. It's just another type of death penalty that a person can be sentenced to. So that's the way Rashi learns it. The Balei Tosafot bring two other reasons which they reject as being not as sound as Rashi's reasoning. The first of which is that they say, Yesh mifashim isham b'nei noach, azaratam zui mitatan. When it comes to the Shiva mitzvah b'nei noach, the lav, the negative precept, is their warning and also their death penalty. That means when they violate a lav, they are subject to a death penalty. A Yisrael who violates a lav only gets malkot. But if you look at that equation, you see that the Yisrael is getting malkot, and the Ben Noach is getting a mitah. Or in essence, what you're doing is equating the malkot of the Yisrael to the mitah of the Ben Noach. And that's how you know, like Rava says over here, that malkot are a part and parcel of mitah, or stand in the stead of mitah. The other possibility that he brings over here is, Vod Yesh Lemar, Mishom, the Zimni Meitim Ma'idei Malkot. Sometimes the person who's being punished through the lashes dies. Now, we try to avoid that, and we'll see in the Gemara that we do things to prevent the person from dying, but nevertheless, there are people who die from the lashes, from the corporal punishment. And so that's why it's considered or classified like a death penalty, because sometimes it results in death. But those would, again, reject both of those answers as being very sound answers, and think that Rashi is right over here about saying that it's because you are a moreid b'malchut, you're really subject to the death penalty, and God, in a sense, gave you a reprieve by giving you a malkot. But the malkot is really instead of what you should have really gotten, which was a death penalty. Now, the simplest way to read it might be to say that what I had suggested when we read it in the Mishnah is something along the lines of what the Rabbeinu Tam says with regards to the Gemara when it comes to on Shabbat. How do you know that a chabura or chavala on Shabbat is chayav? And so over there we say, Mali mita mu'etet, mali mita miruba. What's the difference between a little death and a big death? In that an injury or a wound to an individual is just the beginning of a process to lead to a death penalty. And so, in a sense, a wound is just the first step towards death. And so that's how the Rabbeinu Tam, in discussing this issue with regards to Hilchot Shabbat, that chavalah is just a little shechita. Or it's a derivative of shechita, possibly. And so to over here, you would say the same thing. Makot are just a smaller form of death. It's injury. It's causing a wound on the individual. So it doesn't result in their complete death, but the wounding or the hurting of the individual is the equivalent of a process that would lead to death. It's a small death rather than a big death. If you read it that way, that's another possible maybe way to explain this idea of makot mkom mita umedet. Amar Ravach Abrei the Rav of the Ravashi, Eochi, if that's the case, Umdana Lomali. Why do we have to then assess what are the number of lashes that this person can sustain? Lemachie, you give him the lashes. V'mait, limot. If he dies, he dies. If Malkot are in place of Mitah, then why do we care if he dies? That's exactly what the Malkot are. They're a death penalty, quote unquote. If that's the case, we should just hit him and give him the lashes. If he survives, great. If he doesn't survive, and El Kanami, it's a death penalty. Amalei, Amar Kra, the Pasuk says, V'nikla achicha le'enecha. When you give him the malkot, then v'nikla achicha le'enecha, it's not clear which of the two words the Gemara is playing on. Is if it's the nikla, that he will become embarrassed because of the lashes that are being given to him, and a person can only be embarrassed when they're alive, or is it because it says achicha? Nikla achicha, he's your brother, he's only your brother while he's still alive. Ki machit agava dechaye machit. When he gives the lashes, you gotta be hitting a live person, and not a dead person. And again, for one of the two reasons, it's because of nikla or achicha that we just quoted. Elahadatanyo, what about this bright? Amdu lekabel esrim, they assessed that he could handle 20 lashes. Ein makinoto ela makot aruyot lehishtalish. We only allow you to give makot that are divisible by 3. That means, v'kamahin, what's the closest divisible number by 3 over here? The answer would be 21. But we don't go up one more because we have assessed that they can only handle 20. So then we have to drop down to the number beforehand that is divisible by 3, and that is tamne sari, 18. So we'll give him 18 malkot instead of the 20 because it has to be divisible by 3 for the reasons that we'll learn in the Gemara Makot and in Sanhedrin about the fact that they hit him on his back 2/3 of the lashes and on his front 1/3 of the lashes. So we need a number that is divisible by 3 in order to do that. So over here, the Gemara thinks, wait a minute, I am at 20, so now I have a choice. To get it divisible by 3, I can either go down to 18 or I can go up to 21. So limchuya yisrim b'chada. Instead of giving him 18, give him 21. V'chimait b'chada limot. If he dies, he's going to die on the last lash. Because 20, we assess that he would be fine and he would survive. So if he doesn't survive, the only reason is because of the 21st lash. But that's fine. You just needed him to be alive for the lashes. He was alive for all the lashes and he only died on the last lash. That would be fine. According to your reasoning, why wouldn't we give him 21 instead of 18? Da'aki machit, agaba dechayaka machit. He's hitting or giving lashes to a live person and therefore it would work. Amar le, amar kra, the pasuk says, nikla achicha le'enecha, achar shalaka, achicha be'ina veleka. It says over here that it has to result in there being an achicha that is there in the end. That nikla achicha means he will be embarrassed, but he will be your achicha in the end. That achicha is someone who's alive. If they're not alive, then he's not achicha. And so therefore you have to give him malkot that will result in him being alive after the malkot are given. So not only does he have to be alive for the malkot, he also have to be alive post the Malkot. And for that reason, we don't round up to get a number divisible by 3, as well as the fact that we do not just give a Malkot without regard to what he can handle. Iber HaChodesh B'Shlosha. The setting of the month is with 3. I'm saying that loosely because you'll see in a second. Chishub Loktani. It doesn't say the calculation. Now the calculation of the month can come for one of two ways. Rashi already here indicates the calculation is based on the fact that the Mishnah in Arachin tells us you can't have more than 8 chadoshim mele'im in a year. You can't have more than 8 months that are 30 days long. As well as you can't have more than 8 months that are chaserim, that are only 29 days. And so the chishub would be the calculation to figure out whether you've exceeded that limit, or you haven't exceeded that limit, or this will cause you or not cause you to exceed the limit. So that's one chishub you might be doing. The other chishub might have to do with the molad. When is the molad alevana? Therefore, when the Edim come to testify about sighting the moon, you'll know whether it makes sense that they saw the moon and where you would expect the moon to be. So that might be the chishuv that we're speaking about here. But what the Gemara says is the word chishuv is not used in the Mishnah. So that can't be what we're speaking about. Kiddush Loktani. It also doesn't say in the Mishnah, Kiddush HaChodesh requires Shlosha, but rather, Ibor. Only the Ibor is what the Mishnah says. The Gemara says, we can take care of Ibor, no problem. Ibor means make the month into an Ibor month, which means a 30-day month or MLA. So what do you need anything for? Why do you need a Beit Din at all? Lo dekadsho, don't be mekadesh the month on the 30th day, meaning that you have 29 days of the previous month. On what would be the 30th day of that month, you don't be mekadesh the chodesh. And then, umemela la'aber. And then it will happen by itself on the next day, meaning that on the 31st day, it automatically will be Rosh Chodesh of the next month, because you can't have a month that's more than 30 days. So what do you need a Beit Din for at all? If you're going to be talking about an Ibor HaChodesh, which means expanding the month into a Malay, then don't do anything. And that will happen. What do you need a Beit Din to be involved at all? So the first answer is given by Abayi, Amar Abayi, Tnei Kiddush HaChodesh. Amen. The Mishnah to read Kiddush HaChodesh and not Ibor HaChodesh. Tanya no Miyachi, we have a bright that supports that. Kiddush HaChodesh, V'Ibur HaShana, B'Shlosha. The sanctification of the month requires three, just like the Ibur HaShana. Intercalating the calendar also requires three. But you see here the word uses Kiddush HaChodesh in the Tosefta and not Ibur HaChodesh. Divrei Rabbi Meir, Amarova, V'Ibur Ktani. It's a great explanation of Abaye, but that's not what our Mishnah says. Our Mishnah says Ibur. So why are you telling me that it says Kiddush when it says Ibur? Yeah, the Tosefta says Kiddush as well, but that's not what our Mishnah says, as Rashi notes, that a Tana is not going to get mixed up between words. He might leave out a word. He might make a small change in a word. He's not going to completely get the wrong word in there. Elomer Robo, so Robo says the explanation is this. Kiddush v'yom Ibur. If you are Mekadesh the Chodesh on the 30th day, which means make the previous month a Chaser and make that Rosh Chodesh, then Bishlosha, you need three Adayanim for that situation. Achar Ibur, if it's after the 30th day is already passed, Leka Kiddush. There's no necessity for Kiddush HaChodesh. The reason being is that you need, when it comes to the 29th day, and then the 30th day would be Rosh Chodesh, you need to do something actively in order to make that day Rosh Chodesh versus leaving that day alone and it becoming the 30th day of the month. So that requires active intervention, and that's why you require a Beit Din of Shlosha. Then that if you do absolutely nothing, you go to sleep, close your eyes, then the Kiddush HaChodesh will happen automatically on the 31st day, because the other month will be 30, and on the 31st day will be Rosh Chodesh of the next month, whether or not you do anything, or whether or not you intervene. Umani, and who's the author of this position? Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok. The time Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok Omer, Im lo nira bizmano, if the Levana was not seen in its time, ein mekachinoto, then there's no Kiddush HaChodesh that month, shekvar kidshuhu bashamayim, because it's already sanctified in the heavens. The Tosfot over here brings one explanation of what it means sanctified in the heavens, which is that they know when the Molad is. And up in Shamayim, whatever the real Molad is, that's when the Rosh Chodesh happens, and that's when the Kiddush HaChodesh happens. So then he would be saying over here that if the month is going to be a 30-day month, and therefore the Rosh Chodesh of the next month will be on the 31st day, in that scenario, you don't have to do anything. Shekvar kitshuah b'shamayim, because the Molad already captured it. The Balei Tosafot bring that reason and reject it because it doesn't make any sense. The Molad can sometimes be before even the first day of possible testimony, meaning that even before the 30th day, and then the night after the 29th, going to the 30th day, they might have been able to have a Molad then already. So then why should it be Mekadesh the Chodesh on that day as well? But rather, the Balei Tosafot suggests that it means Shefar Kitshua Bashamayim, he says Kaperish HaKuntris, like Rashi says in the second parak in Rosh Hashanah, to be Yom Shoshim Mamtimin Beitin Shomalo the Beitin Shomato, on the 30th day of the previous month, Beitin upstairs waits to see if Beitin Shomato does anything. Shema Yabru, maybe they'll make it into a Rosh Chodesh. Aval, Yom Shloshim Ve'achad, Sheyefshar Shalo Kitsho Ayom, and since on the 31st day there's nothing else to happen except for it to be Rosh Chodesh, then Mekadeshin Oto B'Shamayim Min HaShachar. Then in the morning, Min HaShamayim, they're already Mekadeshit. Rashi over here says that they actually are Mekadeshit Veitin Shalomalo Mi Etmol, already from yesterday, which makes it sound like it's already from the night before that they are Mekadesh the Chodesh. But in either case, the Kiddush HaChodesh happens by itself. And since it happens by itself, you don't need a Veitin for that aspect of it. And now Robo is saying the Mishnah means, if you do Kiddush HaChodesh on the Yom HaIbur, then you need three. You do the Kiddush HaChodesh after the day of Ibur, you don't need the three because it's taken care of in Shemayim. And this is similar to the position of Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok, who says you only need Kiddush HaChodesh if it is a Chaser, you don't need Kiddush HaChodesh if it is a Malay. Now the truth is that this does have an implication to Halacha. I'll just mention it in passing, which is the question as to whether when you forget Yalei V'Yavo and Rosh Chodesh, do you have to go back and repeat Shmon Esrei? So when it comes to a 2 days of Rosh Chodesh, on the first day of Rosh Chodesh, if you forget it at night, and even on a 1 day Rosh Chodesh, if you forget it at night, you don't have to go back and repeat Shmon Esrei, because ain baked in mikatshin balaylo. Because Kiddush HaChodesh can never happen at night, it can only happen during the day. So therefore, your leaving out of Yalei V'Yavo is not as significant at night as it is during the day, because there couldn't have been any Kiddush HaChodesh at night. So now, that might only be true on the first day of Rosh Chodesh, or on a Chaser, on the only day of Rosh Chodesh, because there, Beit Din is actively being Mekadosh the Chodesh on that day. But on the hand, when it comes to the second day of Rosh Chodesh, or a case where it's a Malay, then in that case, does the application of Ein Mekadshin Balayla have any relevance? If, like Rabbi Elazar ben Tzaddik says over here, Kfar Kitshua Bashamayim, it's done in the Shamayim, maybe in the Shamayim they're not subject to that rule. That actually might be what the difference between Rashi and the Baal Tosfot over here. The Baal Tosfot say that Beit Din Shamala does it in the morning, like the Beit Din Shamato. That's the case, then we could say it. Even about the Beit Din Shamala, Ein Mekadshin Machodesh Balayla. On the other hand, Rashi says that it's already Metmol. From the night before, it's already Mekudash, because there's no other choice. And that's what it means, Beit Din Shamala is Mekadesh the Chodesh. Because that already happens the night before. If that's the case, if you forget Yalav V'Yalva that night, you should have to repeat it, because the day is already Kadosh. Or, the way that you could phrase that Machloket as well is, as to whether there's a necessity for Kiddush HaChodesh on the 31st day. If it happens by itself, Memela, then maybe that lack of necessity of human intervention makes it that you don't need the Kiddush of Beit Din. If you don't need the Kiddush of Beit Din, then it's already Rosh Chodesh from the night before, and you'd have to repeat Yalav V'Yalva. On the other hand, if the Beit Din Shomata still is Mekadosh the Chodesh, even when it is a Malay, despite the fact that Mekadoshim in Almalo, you still are Mekadosh at the Mato, then it would be still subject to the same rules of Ein Mekadoshim at the Chodesh Balayla, and therefore if you forgot Yalav V'Yalva on that night of Rosh Chodesh, you wouldn't need to repeat it because Ein Mekadoshim at the Chodeshim Balayla. So that's just a little sidebar about whether you have to repeat Shmoneh Esrei when you forget Yalav V'Yalva for Rosh Chodesh at night, but it's dependent on the discussions that we're having here about this idea of Kiddush Min HaShamayim. Rav Nachman Amar, now we have a third suggestion as to how to deal with this language in our Mishnah. Kiddush Acharibur B'Shlosha. If the Kiddush HaKodesh is done after the Ibur, meaning on the 31st day, then you need three. B'Yom Ibur, if the previous month was a Chaser and you're doing it on the 30th day, you're making it to Rosh Chodesh, Leka Kiddush. There is no necessity for Kiddush HaKodesh. Umani, who's the author of this position, is the Tana Palimo. Titania Palimo Omer, Bizmano, when it's on time, Ein Mekadshinoto, you don't have to Mekadosh it. Shalo, Bizmano, Mekadshinoto. If it's not in time, then you have to Mekadosh it. Bizmano on time is that the month is always 29 and a half days and 793 Chalakim. So the 29th day is always the last day of the Chodesh. And Zmano for the Moled HaLevana would always be on the 30th day itself. Therefore, that's considered or classified as Zmano, as Rashi notes over here. The Toldato B'Yom Lamedu. The Moled is always on that 30th day, because the lunar cycle is no less than 29 and a half days and 793 Chalakim. So that's considered Zmano enough to do anything, to be Mekadosh. If you want to extend it and make the month before a Malay, and make it a 30-day month beyond the Zman of the Moled HaLevana, then in that instance, you have to be Mekadosh the Chodesh. So that's the opposite of what you just said in Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok, who says you have to be Mekadosh it if you do it on the 30th day. You don't have to be Mekadosh it if you do it on the 31st day. Palimo says just the opposite. If you do it on the 30th day, meaning that the previous month's Chaser with 29 days, the 30th day becomes the first day of the next month, Rosh Chodesh, then you don't have to be Mekadosh the Chodesh. On the other hand, if you make it on the 31st, meaning that the previous month is a Malay in 30 days, and you make Rosh Chodesh on the 31st day, that'll be the first day of the next month, then you do require Kiddush HaChodesh, because that's not the standard lunar cycle. You've extended it beyond the normal lunar cycle. Rav Ashi Amar, now we have a fourth attempt to explain this line in the Mishnah, Olam Chishuv Ktoni. It really means Chishuv, the calculation of the Chodesh. Umay Ibur. What is Ibur? Chishuv the Ibur is the calculation for the necessity of the Ibur. It means the calculation of the Rosh Chodesh, and that goes back to what we said before, that Chishuv HaKodesh is either figuring out how many Malay and Chaser you can have during the year, or figuring out when the Molad should be, and that you require Beit Din of Shlosha for. But, as far as Ibur HaKodesh is concerned, there you do not need Edim. As Rashi notes over here, this subscribes to the position that you do not have to be Mekadosh the Chodesh, both Malay or Chaser, as the Gemara is going to say in 1 second, but I did the Kabay the Midnei Ibur Shana, Tanini Anami Ibur Chodesh. So since it had to write Ibur by the year, the intercalating of the calendar, so over here, for parallel structure in the Mishnah, it said Ibur HaChodesh, even though what it really meant was Chishuv HaChodesh. Now the Gemara says, okay, based on your statement now, there's a requirement of a Beit Din for Chishuv HaKodesh in, for Kiddush HaKodesh, lo. But when it comes to the sanctification of the Kodesh, you don't need a Beit Din. Mani, who's the author of that position? Rabbi Eliezer, he. The Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, and Rashi, it's Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon Omer, Ben Bismano, Ben Shalom Bismano, whether you have a Chaser or a Malay, you're making Rosh Chodesh on the 30th day, or the 31st day, the previous month was 29, or the previous month was 30, Ein Mekadshin Oto, Beit Din does not have to be Mekadosh to Chodesh, Shnemar, V'kidashtem et Shnat HaChamishim Shana, says with regards to the Yovel, that you have to sanctify the 50th year. And over here it uses the Hei HaYidiyah, HaChamishim Shana, the 50th year, Shanim Atam Mekadesh, V'yatam Mekadesh Chodoshim, years you are Mekadesh, you have to sanctify, months you do not have to sanctify. That means that Beit Din is instructed to count each year of the Ovel, and to say this is the first year of the Ovel, the second year of the Ovel, all the way till the Ovel itself. So there's a requirement of Kiddush Beit Din, but when it comes to the month of the year, there is no requirement of Kiddush Beit Din, and simply calculating what you need it to be, and declaring it that, is enough. So therefore, according to Ravashi, the reading of the Mishnah should have been Chishuv HaKodesh Ibur HaShana. But since it used Ibur HaShana, it also uses Ibur by the Chodesh, and we call it Ibur HaChodesh. But that says that the only requirement for a Beit Din is the Chishuv HaKodesh, not for the Kiddush HaKodesh. We say that aligns with the position of Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, who says there's no requirement of Kiddush HaChodesh, only a requirement of Chishuv HaKodesh. And as Rashi notes over here, the meaning of Ibur HaChodesh is going to be different than Ibur HaShana. By Ibur HaShana, by definition, not only do you have to do a chishuv, but you also have to take active intervention in order for there to be a leap year. Because if you don't intervene and make it into a leap year, then the month after Adar will be Nisan. If you intervene, then the month after Adar will be Adar Bet. So only through your intervention will that actually happen. So therefore, by Ibur HaShana, you have to use the word Ibur because you need to be Mekadosh, you need to intervene in order for this to happen. So that's why by the Shana, you need the word Ibur to tell you have to, in essence, be Mekadosh the year or make the year into a leap year. So that's why you have to use the language of Ibur by Shana and not use the language of Chishuv. And therefore, for parallel structure, to also use the word Ibur by Chodesh. But by the Chodesh, the Ibur mean Chishuv and not Ibur at all. Like Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, who says that there's no requirement of sanctification at all, and therefore Ibur HaChodesh could be Lav Dafka Ibur HaChodesh, but rather Chishuv HaChodesh, but put in there to parallel the Ibur that's found by the Shana. Now Tosafot takes issue with that explanation of Rashi, because he says it's not true. You can't intervene on the last day of Adar and make that into Adar Bet instead of Nisan, because the Gemara says that you're not allowed to make Adar Bet or make it a leap year when you've already come to a day that could have been Nisan. You can't declare it on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Instead of it being Rosh Chodesh Nisan, it's Rosh Chodesh Adar Bet. You can't make that declaration on that day. And so therefore the Baal Tosafot say Rashi wasn't so careful because it's just not true. That declaration, that decision has to be made much earlier than that point in time. And so what Rashi says is that if you didn't do anything and it would may become Nisan, that's not true because your statement or your intervention takes place earlier. That's not so it has nothing to do with the Rosh Chodesh or the Kiddush HaChodesh. And number two, the Baal Tosafot point out that this Tana, as we're seeing here with Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, doesn't believe you need Kiddush anything. You don't need Kiddush HaKodesh, and you also don't need Kiddush HaShana. Rather, you just need an Amirah. You need a statement that declares that it will be a leap year, but you don't need a sanctification of the month in order for it to become a leap year. And then, when it comes to the testimony of the Edim, that they saw the new moon on that given day, it would automatically become Adar Bet, and not Nisan because of the declaration that was made earlier. So the Baalei Tosafot disagree on two levels with Rashi. First of all, there's no Kiddush by the addition of the extra month or declaring of the Adar Bet. It's simply an Amirah. It's a declaration, not a sanctification that's done earlier. And number two is that decision has to be done earlier according to the Baalei Tosafot versus Rashi, who thinks that decision can be made on Rosh Chodesh itself. The Gemara continues, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer Bishlosha. This is with regards to Ibur HaShana. And we start out with 3, then we move to 5, and then we move to 7. Tanya, we have a brayta. Ketzad amar Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. What is the scenario or the description that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel gives in our Mishnah where Bishlosha Matchilin, you start out with 3 judges. Bichamisha nosim notim, with 5 you deliberate. Bigomrim Bishiva. And then you come to a verdict or a decision with 7. So now the Brayta explains to you what are the scenarios in which this happens. Echad Omer Leshev, they have three individuals looking into the matter as thinking as to whether they should have a leap year this year or not. One of them says we should sit and deliberate about the issue. Shnayim Arim Shelo Leshev, and two of them say no necessity to deliberate, we don't think they need a leap year at all. But tell Yachid b'miuto, the rove governs, and therefore we don't look into the matter at all. Shnayim Omer Leshev, if two of them say that we should look into the matter of adding an extra month to this year, and the other one says, we don't need to sit down, we don't need it. Mosifim aleim od shnayim. To those original three, we add on an additional two individuals. Vinosim notim badavar. And then they deliberate about the issue. Shnayim omrim tzricha. If two of them say we need a leap year, shlosha omrim eina tzricha. Three of them say, we do not need a leap year, but lo shnayim b'miutan. The minority, the two, are wiped out or eliminated by the majority that rules over here, the three. Shlosha omrim tzricha, if three of them say that you do need a leap year, ushnayim omrim eina tzricha, and two of them say we do not need a leap year, mosifilim od shnayim. Then we add on an additional two to the grouping of five, she'ena minyan pachot mishiv'a, because the final verdict can only be rendered by seven. And so here, where the majority by five would have ruled in favor of making a leap year, they add on two to come to a conclusion with seven dayanim. Hani shlosha chamisha mishiva keneged mi. These judges, the three, the five, the seven, what is the precedent or paradigm by which they are patterned? Pligi ba Rabbi Yitzchak bar Nachmani v'chadime. It's an argument between Rabbi Yitzchak bar Nachmani and another person that was with him. Umanu, who's the person with him? Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi. And some say that the Masorah was this way. Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi, v'chadimei. So Rabbi Shimon Pazi and somewhat with him who are disagreeing. Umanu, who's the person with him, is Rabbi Yitzchak bar Nachmani. So then it's a machlok between Rabbi Yitzchak bar Nachmani and Shimon ben Pazi. Chadamar k'neged birkat kohanim. One of them says that it's k'neged birkat kohanim. Birkat kohanim is comprised of three psukim, three brachot, and each bracha has an additional two words in it. The first bracha has three words in it, second bracha has five words in it, and the third bracha has seven words in it. And so, keneged the 3, 5, 7 of Birkat Kohanim, we also have 3, 5, 7 by the Ibur HaShana. V'chadamar, shlosha, keneged Shomrei Asaf, three, keneged the Shomrei Asaf, chamisha miroi pnei HaMelech, five of the individuals who see the face of the king, Shiva roi pnei HaMelech, and the seven that see the face of the king. So over here, Rashi explains, what are these? Shomrei Asaf, roi pnei HaMelech. He says that the Shomrei Asaf are mentioned by Galut Tzidkiyahu, by the Churban HaBayit. Here, now we're in the 9 days, in the last parak in Melachim Bet. Gavei Galut Nebuzaradin, v'ata nami mishkach ha-chamisha roi pnei HaMelech. Over there also mentions the five roi pnei HaMelech. And Achashverosh, Shemegilat Esther, it mentions the Shiv'a Sarei Pares Sumadai, and that's the seven that we're speaking about here. The Balei Tosafot, on the other hand, disagree with Rashi about the seven and say, why would we use Achashverosh as a precedent for any number, or set a precedent for how we would act with regards to Yibur HaShana? And therefore, the Balei Tosafot said that Shivaro Pnei HaMelech comes out of the last parak in Yirmiyahu. So both the last parak in Melachim and the last parak in Yirmiyahu both describe the Churban HaBayit, and then the Galut of the individuals. And in that process of the Galut, it says, in Perek Kafei, Pasuk Yudchet, in Melachim, Beikach Rav HaTabachim, et Sraya HaKoen, HaRosh, Vetzfani HaKoen, Mishneh, Vetzloshet Shomrei HaSaf. These are the people that he takes into Galut. Unumeir Lakach, Sarisacha, the Shupkid, Alanjeh Minchama, V'chamisha Anashim Ro'eim Pnei HaMelech, Hashem Nimtzu Bayir, את סופר שר הצבא המצבא את עם הארץ, ו-60 איש מעם הארץ הנמצאים בעיר. ויקח אותם נבוזרדן, so the general takes them, רב הטבחים, ילך אותם על מלך בבל, רבלוטה, he takes them to the king of בבל in רבלוטה. So here mentioned in that פסוק יבוא שלושי שומרי אסף, as well as חמישה רואי פני המלך. And in Ermiyahu, where he has almost the identical פסוקים, it says, ויקח רב הטבחים, וכולי וכולי, and it says, מנהיר לקח סריס אחד אשר היה פקיר אנשי המלחמה, ושבעה אנשים ראי פני המלך, אשר נמצאו בעיר. Instead of saying חמישה, like it says in המלאכים, over here in ימיהו, it says seven ראי פני המלך. את סופר שר הצבא המצבא את עם הארץ, ושישים איש מעם הארץ הנמצאים מתוך העיר. So that's where you get the 3, 5, and 7 according to Tosafot. Now, what's interesting about both of these reasons is that neither of them really give any insight as to what the reason is that we have 3, 5, and 7. Both of the reasons give you a paradigm where we have such a structure of 3, 5, and 7, but neither of the explanations seems to explain to us why you need 3, 5, and 7, not just what is a precedent or paradigm of 3, 5, and 7. So there are explanation Rashi notes over here. The Ibra Shanami Taksisei Malchut Shamayimhi. That the intercalating of the calendar is like the trappings of royalty of the Shamayim. The Shev Seder Shanim Al Mechunan. In order to ensure that the years are working properly and that everything is adjusted properly. That is part of the job of Shamayim, of Malchut Shamayim. And therefore, Ibra Shana is in some ways connected or correlated with Malchut Shamayim and the trappings of Malchut Shamayim. And therefore, it would be appropriate to use what would be a setup of royalty, like we say, the Shomrei Asaf, Roei Pnei HaMelech, the 3, 5, and 7. That's Rashi's explanation. Others explain with regards to Birkat Kohanim, and you can see something along these lines in the Marsha, that just like by Birkat Kohanim, you have the 3 brachot, and then after the 3 brachot, it says, V'ani Avarchem, God is maskim al yedei, the bracha of the Kohanim to the Am, Hashem is maskim al yedah. So too, by Ibar Hashana, the Beit Din Shalmal, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu, was maskim to the decision of the Chachamim with regards to Ibar Hashana. So that way, there's a more fundamental connection between the reasons that are brought and the reason that we require 3, 5, and 7 in this instance. So I'm really a Abayder of Yosef. So Abay says, Rav Yosef, I did not my time alone parishlon mar hochi. Rav Yosef, why didn't you explain this to us before? We didn't know about this 3, 5, 7 business and the reason for it. Why didn't you tell us about this before? He said, I didn't know that you were interested in this. I didn't know that you needed this information. Have you ever queried something of me and I haven't answered you? And that if you ask the question, I'm happy to answer. I just didn't think that this was a question. I didn't think this might have been of interest to you. But once I do know about it, I'm happy to teach you about it. And that's what I did now. I taught you about it. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots in the bottom of Yud Amud Bet.